we're responsible for the welfare of our people. We're almost like the tribes down lower 48 in Alaska.
The debate over whether Alaska Native corporations should represent tribes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, October 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Rock Creek Gold Mine closes down near Nome.
We had a lot of interest, but we were not able to find the kind of buyer that we really wanted.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
A former Alaska lawmaker facing retrial on federal corruption charges plans to plead guilty this week. Vic Horing will change his plea on count one of the indictment against him, according to his lawyers. Horing and another former lawmaker, Pete Cott, were scheduled to be retried after their earlier convictions were thrown out for prosecutorial errors. Cott last week signaled his intent to plead guilty as well in his case. Anchorage Daily News reporter Richard Maurer has been covering the story and joins me now. Hi, Rich.
Hey, how you doing?
I am well. What are Cott and Horing going to plead guilty to?
Well, Horing was facing a three-count indictment. He's going to plead guilty to a single count of conspiracy to commit extortion. Pete also was facing three counts. He's going to plead guilty to bribery. Pete Cott.
Do you have any sense of what kind of a plea deal they may have worked out?
You know, I don't. The government isn't talking. Their sides aren't talking. Clearly, there is a full plea bargain. It wouldn't surprise me if they end up getting just time served plus some extended period of supervised release probation.
It does seem difficult to imagine them agreeing to go back to prison.
I'd say so. Pete Cott really had more of an incentive to plea because he had a 6-year sentence altogether, and the one charge he agreed to plead guilty to only carries 5 years. So under any circumstance, he'd have the worst outcome he can imagine. He'd shave a year off his term. Vic Horing had been sentenced to 42 months, 3.5 years. So he likely had some kind of deal that was worked out that's going to save him some time as well, maybe all the rest of his time. They both served about more or less half their sentences.
And Rich, as you've just reminded us, these former lawmakers were both convicted previously. Remind us now why they're headed back to trial.
You're right. They're both convicted in 2007 after trials. Juries in Anchorage found them both guilty on 3 of their 4 counts. As many of the listeners might remember, after that, Senator Ted Stevens was tried in Washington, D.C., with a very aggressive legal defense team. They, through their efforts and also through the trial judge, uncovered what would appear to have been some failure by the government to turn over favorable evidence to the defense, in particular information about the lead witness, Bill Allen, in the case. That, in turn, resulted in them not getting a fair trial, according to the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals.
This has been going on for quite some time. What's still left hanging in this corruption probe that began several years ago?
There's not much hanging at all. These are most likely the last of the defendants. The only other thing that's lingering is what's going to happen with the prosecutors. Judge Sullivan, the judge in Washington, D.C., who presided over the Stevens trial, hired a special prosecutor to investigate the prosecution team for malfeasance, essentially. That's been going on for a couple of years now. Nothing's ever come out of that. There's also a Justice Department investigation, and that's sort of unknown. But it appears that all the defendants who are ever going to be charged have been charged.
Richard Maurer is an investigative reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. There's a power struggle going on between Alaska Native tribes and corporations, and that battle was taken to Washington, D.C. last week. The board chairman of the Sea Alaska Native Corporation in Southeast, Albert Kukesh, was in Washington with the Alaskan Federation of Natives, for whom he serves as co-chair. He was attending an event designed to bring unity to the Alaska Native and American Indian message. But Kukesh used some of his time in a White House meeting to advocate for corporations. He and other representatives of the Alaska Federation of Natives met with Kim Teehee, President Obama's senior policy advisor for Native American affairs. And Kukesh says he told her corporations need more recognition in Alaska.
We talked to her about the education process and how we are somehow involved because we're corporations. We're kind of excluded from, example, Indian Education Act. We're excluded from the Repatriation Act because we're corporations. We just said we don't want to be the driving force, but we want to be consulted because we represent tribal members.
Kukesh says corporations want to join groups like the National Congress of American Indians, which called for last week's indigenous gathering in Washington. He at first said Alaskans can't join NCAI, but then clarified to explain that Alaska's tribes can, but not its corporations.
We can participate, even though we're responsible for the welfare of our people. We're responsible for the land base that we have in Alaska. We're responsible for cultural issues in Alaska. We're almost like the tribes on Lower 48 in Alaska.
Those are troublesome words for some tribal leaders in Alaska who see the mission and responsibility of the corporations as very different from that of tribes. Kukesh's comments upset David Harrison, executive director for the Alaska Intertribal Council. He says calling corporations like Lower 48 tribes hurts the actual Alaskan tribes.
It does a lot of damage and actually is an act of genocide because he's helping create a condition of life that is calculated to bring about the physical destruction of a people. And he's also creating conditions of life that are calculated to bring about the physical destruction of the group in whole or part.
Harrison says there's a fundamental need for true tribes that's different from the corporation's mission of making money. He's fighting Kukesh's statements.
I disagree. They have some of our lands, and with as much money as those corporate management is taking home, getting rich off the blood of their own people, while our people are suffering in the villages, not being able to go hunt, fish, and gather, they're not doing their job.
Harrison says he's trying to get as many tribal representatives as possible at this week's Alaska Federation of Natives gathering in Anchorage to speak up about the role of tribes, and later at this month's National Congress of American Indians gathering in Portland. NovaGold will permanently close the troubled Rock Creek mine in Nome. KNOM's Ben Matheson has the story.
The mine has been shut down for nearly 3 years, but it's now official. NovaGold will close the open-pit gold mine located 6 miles northwest of Nome. The company announced the decision last week with its third-quarter financial results. For the past year, NovaGold had been simultaneously soliciting offers for the mine and preparing for closure. NovaGold President and CEO Rick Van Nieuwenhuis said the company had specific criteria for the buyer, as they sought someone with operations experience, financing ability, and a commitment to operate the mine responsibly.
We were not able to find the kind of buyer that we really wanted. We had a lot of interest, but not that met those three criteria. So the board came to the decision earlier this quarter to close the mine and to prepare the mine for closure.
The company has submitted a new draft closure plan to the State Department of Natural Resources, but the details are still being worked out by NovaGold, the state, and landowners. The Sitnisok Native Corporation owns surface rights, and the Bering Strait Native Corporation has subsurface rights. Van Nieuwenhuis says the draft plan calls for major earth-moving operations, the deconstruction of its tailings dam, and ensuring that the immediate environment is protected from the 100,000 tons of tailings.
Such that they're isolated and not able to interact with the rest of the environment out there. There's a modest amount of tailings behind the dam that, as you know, the mine only operated for a short period of time, so there aren't a lot of tailings, so it's a relatively small amount of work.
NovaGold expects to spend around $27 million on the project. The company has shipped earth-moving equipment up on the last barge this year and will be able to work some this winter. The bulk of work should be complete by the end of next summer. A 2-year environmental monitoring program will follow the closure. Around 30 jobs will be lost at Rock Creek. The mine ceased operations in November of 2008 with financial difficulties and violations of its stormwater permit. The company paid a nearly $900,000 fine in 2009 to the EPA for a violation of the Clean Water Act. There were also mechanical issues with the crusher and federal safety fines levied to a contractor following 2 deaths on site. Rock Creek represented NovaGold's first project as a full-scale producer instead of as an exploration firm. The mine was expected to produce around 100,000 ounces of gold annually and generate $25 to $35 million a year in cash flow. The company hoped to use the cash flow from Rock Creek to finance work at its larger projects. Van Nieuwenhuyse said this summer that Rock Creek does not fit in the company's plan going forward. NovaGold is focusing its efforts on the Donlin Creek, Galore Creek, and Ambler projects. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Elders and Youth Conference focuses on helping young Native men.
Our young men are being watched all the time. People are watching to see you fail. Prove them wrong.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
A federal judge has thrown out a key section of a 2008 Interior Department rule that declared global warming is threatening the survival of the polar bear. U.S. District Judge Emmett Sullivan ruled that the Bush administration did not complete a required environmental review when it said the bear's designation as threatened could not be used to control greenhouse gases blamed for global warming. The Obama administration agreed a year later, saying that activities outside of the bear's habitat, such as emissions from a power plant, could not be controlled using the Endangered Species Act. Sullivan's decision directs the Obama administration to set out a timetable for completing the required environmental review. Environmental organizations don't want greenhouse gases left out of consideration for protections for the bears. Sullivan left the interim 2008 designation intact while the case continues. A bipartisan group of U.S. senators wants to extend the expiring Secure Rural Schools program for another 5 years. The annual payments have provided hundreds of millions of dollars for school districts in national forests around the country, including schools throughout Southeast Alaska. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
Congress originally passed the Secure Rural Schools Act in 2000. Using money from the Treasury, it increased and stabilized the forest receipt payments that had once depended on federal revenue from timber sales and other economic activity on national forest lands. That revenue declined substantially with the decline in the timber industry. The Senate's proposed 5-year extension for secure schools also includes funding for payment in lieu of taxes through 2017. PILT is a separate program that compensates local governments for the fact that they can't tax federal property within their boundaries. Alaska Republican Lisa Murkowski is co-sponsoring the measure along with several other senators, both Democrats and Republicans.
We recognize that there is an obligation that is out there, so while we're wrestling with with budgets and how we find ways to pay for the obligations. I think the recognition here on a bipartisan basis is this is an obligation of the federal government. Let's figure out how we're going to meet that obligation.
Reauthorizing secure rural schools could be a tough sell to other lawmakers who say they want to slash spending, especially those lawmakers whose states don't benefit from the program. According to Murkowski, that's part of the reason sponsors included PILT in the mix.
Certain parts of the country just don't understand the rationale behind the Secure Rural Schools funding because they don't have timber-dependent areas, areas that are held in U.S. Forest Service status. They can't relate to that. Well, they can relate to PILT monies because they have military reservations in their state. They have areas that are under federal ownership.
The measure is positive news to school officials in Alaska who've been bracing for the complete loss of secure rural schools funding next year. Rob Thomason is school superintendent for Petersburg, which has received well over $1 million a year from the program.
I just think it's a great move forward for the stability of the program that a lot of our school districts in Southeast have, Wrangell and Cake and all of us that receive those funds. It's important.
The Senate bill would ratchet down funding 5% a year, and it would start at a lower level of annual funding than advocates had hoped. For instance, according to Senate estimates, Alaska's payments in 2012 would total roughly $18 million. That's nearly $7 million less than the peak payment year for secure rural schools in 2009. Sitka School Board President Lon Garrison says it's basically a compromise, and it's better than nothing.
So far, it looks like what they're talking about is that if this goes forward, there would be very little likelihood that there would be anything after that 5 years. So it's kind of the end of an era, so to speak. I guess what troubles us a little bit about it is whether or not we can really see some movement in terms of management on the national forest that would produce revenue that would come to communities.
Garrison is on the board of the National Forest and County Schools Coalition, which has voiced support for restoring the link to revenues from logging and other economic activity. The House Natural Resources Committee has been considering a proposal that would do that. As proposed in draft language last month, the House measure would require the Secretary of Agriculture generate a predetermined amount of revenue for secure rural schools each year through timber sales, mining, hydropower, recreation, and other projects. Language in the House measure would also supersede existing environmental laws, and environmental advocates have criticized it as impractical and unsustainable. The Senate's Treasury-funded measure, meanwhile, has not yet been scheduled for a hearing. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Tonight, Lake and Peninsula Borough officials are wrapping up the ballot count on the Save Our Salmon initiative in King Salmon. The ballot measure would ban the Lake and Peninsula Borough from issuing permits for large-scale resource extraction, including mining, that would destroy or degrade salmon habitat. It's aimed at stopping the Pebble Mine, a massive gold and copper prospect near salmon spawning grounds. Voter turnout in the mail-in election was high, about 57%. There were 93 question ballots and 515 valid ballots. The vote is unlikely to be the last word on the Pebble Mine project. A challenge to the initiative has already been filed in court. The judge on that case put his decision about whether the initiative is constitutional on hold until November 7th. The results of the vote will be posted on the Lake and Peninsula Borough's website before 10 p.m. this evening. District 1 Republicans say they will likely drop their recall effort against Ketchikan Representative Kyle Johansson. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, the decision comes after the Alaska Division of Elections last week rejected a recall petition application for the Ketchikan lawmaker.
District 1 Republican Chair Dick Coos says a majority of those in attendance at the meeting did not want to proceed with an appeal of the recall application decision.
If you look at the practical matter, it's going to take probably 5.5 months to actually go through a judicial review, and then it'll take another 5 months to get the real petition started and the recall election actually formulated. So that time frame of roughly 9 to 10 months does not fit with our goal of not having the representative go back into the session this January.
The state primary election is in August of next year. Johansson declined to be interviewed for this story. In a written statement, Johansson said he was thankful the state found the recall application lacked, quote, any grounds for removal. The Republican lawmaker angered many of his constituents last November when, during a legislative organizational meeting, he both forfeited his leadership position and walked out of the majority caucus. Prior to walking out, Johansson offered to step down as House Majority Leader if caucus members would agree to give his close personal friend Charisse Millett a seat on the coveted House Finance Committee. After that offer was rejected, Johansson and Millett walked out of the caucus, giving up any and all leadership positions in the legislature. Johansson faced a firestorm of criticism in his home district. Both the Ketchikan Daily News and District 1 Republicans called on Johansson to step down. Johansson refused, and District 1 Republicans proceeded with the recall effort. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
A Shishmaref woman was sentenced to 20 days in jail today because due to her daughter's continued absence from school. This is the second truancy case in as many weeks in the Bering Strait School District that has resulted in parents being sentenced to jail time for their child's poor school attendance. Frida Kuzaguk called in from Shishmaref via teleconference for the hearing. In an agreement with the court, four of the five charges against her were dropped in exchange for her pleading guilty to one count of contributing to the delinquency of a minor. Court papers allege she aided or encouraged her daughter to miss hundreds of days of school over the last 3 years. District Attorney John Earthman said Kuzaguk ignored all efforts by the Shishmaref School and the Bering Strait School District to help her child return to class. He also noted thousands of dollars in unpaid fines. He sought the maximum penalty of 30 days in jail to send a message to like-minded parents. In an affidavit by the Alaska State Trooper, Kuzaguk cited bullying by other students as well as teachers as reasons why her daughter missed so many days of school. Kuzaguk said she had talked to the principal and had her daughter move to a different class, but she continued to miss school, claiming she was scared of the school environment. Kuzaguk will report to Nome on November 21st to be remanded and begin serving her sentence. The biggest tobacco company in the world will be defending themselves in a courthouse in Western Alaska this week. KYUK's Shane Iverson has more.
Philip Morris USA will be the defendant in a wrongful death case brought forward by at least one defendant named in court documents as Dolores Hunter. Hunter filed a civil suit almost 5 years ago in November of 2006. Hunter is also suing the Alaska Commercial Company and Altria Group Incorporated, which is the parent company of Philip Morris. Among a list of food and restaurant products like Kool-Aid and Taco Bell, Philip Morris is more widely known for their cigarette products like Marlboro and Virginia Slims. The court filings for the civil lawsuit were unavailable in Bethel. That's because they're sitting in a Palmer courthouse with the judge that will be trying the case. That's Judge Eric Smith. Smith is scheduled to come to Bethel to conduct the trial before a jury. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
More than 1,000 people are attending the Elders and Youth Conference that started today at the Denina Center in Anchorage. Organizers at the First Alaskans Institute want to provide a forum for building connections. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
Monday's keynote speaker was Tlingit Elder Elaine Abraham of Yakutat. She told the audience an Inupiaq, Tlingit, or other native child traditionally is named after an elder or ancestor. She says the child learns about his or her name, and that tells them their history and place in the world. For instance, she says about 3,000 years ago, the people of Yakutat migrated to southeast Alaska and adopted the Tlingit language and culture. But Abraham says they retained some of their Athabascan roots, especially in their names. She gives statewide leader Byron Malott's Tlingit name as an example.
But the names from 3,000 years ago started in McCarthy and Chikna when we were Athabascans. And Byron of Byron's name started there. He has a name that they can't translate because it's too ancient. But in that name is the history of our migration.
Abraham says naming ceremonies are a good way for people to live in accordance with the conference theme, which is honoring the past, celebrating the present, preparing for the future.
And for the young people that are here today, you're going to take that past that you are learning in the present, and you're going to take it into the future.
Haven Harris, a Nupiak of Nome, introduced a panel on the strength of men, saying it's time for a change.
If you look at Alaska Native men, if it's good to have a high number, graduation rates, income, health statistics, unfortunately, we have a low number. If it's good to have a low number, jail rates, unemployment rates, etc., we have the highest numbers in the state. And it's an average that is only getting worse. But we have the chance and the opportunity to correct this problem.
The speakers on the panel, which included State Representative Reggie Jewell, a Nupiak of Kotzebue, described how they were raised and their role models and sources of inspiration. Then MC Allison Warden, a Nupiak of Kaktovik, asked participants for their reactions.
The most appreciated thing about our Native men is always helping one another. Another thing is going hunting for people with disabilities or can go hunting. And us men like to share with one another, sharing with the elders and families.
Good job. And what is your name?
Matthew Ivanoff.
Okay, one more over here.
Yes.
I appreciate our men who are creative to bond with our young men to be strong. It is important. Our young men are being watched all the time. People are watching to see you fail. Prove them wrong.
Later, Philip Blanchett with the musical group Bamuwa taught the audience a new dance move.
Snow go. All right, this is called the snow go. All right, so you feel free to carry this along. All right, it's real easy to do. Everybody, what you got to do with the snow go is you, of course, got to start the engine. And this is old school style. All right, so grab the handle. One, two, three, boom!
In the afternoon, participants attended workshops on language, culture, leadership, and resilience. The Elders and Youth Conference continues into Wednesday. In Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
Prime it. You're not priming it. Don't flood it now.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Nome, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Daisha Eaton in Dillingham, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Jocelyn Estes in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits. From research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine. And by Condor Airlines, with connecting flights from Barrow, Bethel, Juneau, Kodiak, Nome, and Prudhoe Bay to Anchorage on Alaska Airlines, and continuing nonstop service to Frankfurt. Details at condor.com. October is Alaska Energy Awareness Month, a time to focus on what we're doing to meet Alaska's energy needs and reduce consumption in our everyday lives. For more information, go to akenergyefficiency.org. Energy efficiency in Alaska. It's common sense. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.